Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ho, ho, ho! Merry Christmas! That's what Santa says.
What? You need to eat all those latkes? That's what Hanukkah Harry says.
Hanukkah Harry. Yes, it's December and the holiday season is upon us. Oh, what do you want for Hanukkah, Rob?
Well, Kevin, I want more folks to contribute to our Patreon. What do you want for Christmas, buddy?
I was going
to
see the Angel Cast recording, but I guess I'll see the exact same thing, Rob.
How dare you? You'll never get it. Maybe someone out there will get us that gift. How would they do that, Kevin?
Well, our generous holiday elves should head on over to Patreon.com. That's Patreon.com. And then search for Behind the Curtain Broadway's Living Legends. And then you can set up a monthly donation. Even a dollar a month helps us out. Your contributions help us continue doing what we are doing.
We are self-funded, so we need your help. Have another PBS tote bag. And for Hanukkah, feel free to contribute 8 times a month.
Okay, Rob, now you're pushing it.
Okay, you're right.
I get it.
Right.
I see what you did there.
Okay. Have a safe, healthy, and happy holidays, and head over to patreon.com, Patreon, and leave a nice little gift for your two Broadway-loving elves. You liked that line, didn't you?
I did, actually.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain, and make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends, and follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
Plus, you can always listen to all of our episodes, old and new, on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Broadway World, The Stage Network, and the Broadway Podcast Network.
We're almost up to 450 episodes, so there's a lot to go through.
Jeez.
Well, not only is it the end of the year, it's also the end of the decade.
That is right. Last week, we took a look back on the musicals of the 2010s, and today we are examining the plays of the decade.
And offering his incredible knowledge and sharp sense of humor is one of New York's most beloved critics, Time Out's very own Adam Feldman. Adam, how are you today?
I am great. I'm honored to be on here. It's nice that you think of me when it comes to the end of things.
Adam is the patron saint of conclusion, Adam Feldman. So, you know, everyone has admired your work for such a long time. When did you first become interested in theater?
Oh, gosh. I think like most people, it was when I was a kid. I think most people, I saw plays when I was a kid in summer camp and in local community theater productions, and I was obsessed with watching what was happening on stage. And there was something about it that was so magical for me, even, you know, as a kid. And I wanted to do theater, and I did theater in summer camp and in high school. And I bought a lot of cast albums. And I got
Yes.
You know, and I've said this before, but I was kind of a weird kid. Well, big surprise. But in my particular way, this manifested as a kind of an obsessionality and specifically, with regard to this musical theater, I collected a lot of cast albums, and I was very interested in finding out what other people thought about them. And I didn't have that many other kids to talk about this with in my little high school. So I went to the public library and I would research reviews of these shows. Oh. I would find, I would go to the microfiche in the New York Times and I would look up what Frank Rich said about, you know, whatever show in 1985. And this was a way to tap into a larger conversation for me. And in retrospect, although I never thought I would become a critic, in retrospect, that did set the groundwork a little bit for me. It's always something that I've valued in others. I've always valued the existence of criticism. I like reading what other people have to say about things. I think it spurs my own ideas and it sharpens my own responses. And I'm very pleased and proud to be able to participate in that conversation now.
That's really fantastic. And did you have any desire at any point to actually, you know, be on the other side and to be a performing artist or to be, you know, behind the scenes in like a director or producer capacity?
Well, sure. I mean, I loved performing. Yeah. I still love performing. And I've recently, in the past 10 years, I started performing myself a lot more.
Yes, which is fantastic. Which is really, really fantastic.
Well, I don't know if everyone would think so, but I certainly love doing it. And I hope other people enjoy it when it's on. I've been singing a lot, basically.
Yeah.
Again, and that's another conversation which I'd be delighted to have another time. It's a longer conversation, but I stopped singing for a long time. I started singing again recently. I love it. I do it every week at a place called Club Cumming on Monday nights, and many other places that have been kind enough to host me. But I love performing. For various reasons, it was not what I chose to do. And some of that was practical because, among other things, I was born in Canada and I moved here on certain visas, and so there were practical issues involved. Yeah. But also, I think if I had really wanted to do it, I would have overcome those questions, or I would have moved back to Canada and started, you know, have done something else.
Of course.
I recognized in myself a ceiling of how far I was going to go as a performer, because I think I can be a very good performer. I don't think I can. I'm a limitlessly talented actor.
Ah,
I think there are limits to how well I can inhabit another person.
It doesn't stop a lot of people, but that's okay.
Right, but so. Yeah. But I love performing, and I do it as often as I can. But I started writing. Sort of, I got in it through a back channel.
Oh, tell us about that.
Well, I was, when I moved to New York in the late 90s, I had a job and I had a day job, and I had some time that my job didn't always fill all of my day. And so I spent a lot of time on this internet discussion group, sort of online chat group about theater, several of them, but especially one that was about musical theater. Mm-hmm. And I would get into heated arguments with other enthusiasts. And at one point, someone was starting up the magazine Show Business Weekly again.
Oh, yes.
We love that.
Yeah, and someone wrote to me and said, hey, listen, this is out of the blue, but we like what you've been writing online, and we were wondering if you would like to review for us. And so I said, of course, certainly, of course I would. And so I started doing that, and then thing led to thing. I met Paul Wontorek, the editor of Broadway.com, at a party, and we were talking, and I mentioned that I was doing these things, and he said I should send him some stuff, and I did, and he liked it. And so I started writing reviews for Broadway.com. This is back when they still had reviews.
Yeah.
And I quit my job, and I really sort of decided to throw myself into this strange life. Luckily, a job opened up at Time Out in 2003, and by then I had some clips from Broadway.com and Show Business Weekly, and they liked me, and they hired me. And so here I am, 16 years later.
I love it.
Still at Time Out New York, which
fantastic.
I love.
Fantastic, yeah.
And I will say, and I'm sure I'm speaking for Kevin as well, you know, anytime a new show comes out, the first person we go to check out to see what they thought about it is always you.
Always.
Seriously. Always. Your writing is so fantastic, and you capture so much of what the essence of what the piece is trying to do. So we can't tell you how much we appreciate all that you do. How do you think criticism has changed in the past decade from 2010 to where we are now, which is 2019?
Oh, boy, it's changed a lot. And I guess the first major way in which it's changed is that there's a lot less of it, because there have been major changes, or less of it in a formal way. And let me be clear about that. Mm. The there have been enormous changes in the way that the media culture is structured. And there was a time, you know, I'm the president of the New York Drama Critics Circle, and when the New York Drama Critics Circle was founded, there were 10 daily papers in New York City, and all of them had a devoted theater critic, and that was in addition to magazines, national and otherwise, that also had theater critics. That landscape has changed dramatically, and so there are, these old companies have either died or have been forced to make a lot of very important reductions in the coverage that they make. And certainly when these companies are making decisions about what they can keep and what they can't, when they're making these triage decisions, arts coverage and arts editorial coverage is not a priority. Mm-hmm. And so what we've seen is the disappearance generally of arts coverage and criticism in what remains of these sort of mainstream legacy publications. And those things are not, by and large, being replaced in professional ways in other publications. Now, what you do have meanwhile, is this parallel rise of a kind of crowdsourced criticism, a Yelp-type criticism, where you have people sharing, you know, just everyone from the audience sharing their opinions, and you can find those in places like ShowScore.com and places like that, certainly in the internet chat rooms, which are slightly diminished from where they were at their height a few years ago, but nonetheless still exist. And generally on social media, people just share what they've seen and what they like, and other people share it, and there are influencers. It's a different, but as a professional class, there are fewer critics and they have fewer platforms. That's been a big change.
I was going to ask you, what do you think makes an effective critic?
Well, gosh, I hate to sound basic, but I think it's really just about being as smart as you can and writing as well as you can. It comes down to that for me. I mean, and a baseline knowledge and passion for the art form that you're covering.
Right.
I think if you don't love what you're doing, it's going to show, and it's also going to limit you in how open you can be to the best stuff that you're seeing, because the best stuff that you're seeing will sometimes be a little bit more challenging at first pass.
Mm-hmm.
And an openness to that, a knowledge that will be true, is very helpful. Mm-hmm. And you can get one thing that's great about professional critics is that we see so much. I mean, this is a double-edged sword because I see too much. I see way more than any normal civilian will see. No one's going to see hundreds of shows a year. I'm doing that because it's my job, and also because these tickets are provided to me for free. I would never be able to see this much theater if I were paying for it.
Absolutely.
And most people don't have the time and resources to do it. That's one reason I see all this stuff, is because I do want to help direct people toward what I think is the best use of their time and money. And that's on a basic level what my job is. Right. I am a reviewer. I'm a first pass reviewer. I'm writing about shows a few days after I've seen them. I'm writing about them in quite short form. And I'm writing what I know sometimes will be a first draft of the historical opinion of these shows, in as much as such an opinion will exist. Sometimes I'll look back on shows that I loved at the time and I will barely remember them. And there I will look back on shows that I was sort of confused about or mixed about, and I will find that they have stuck with me in very real and indelible ways. So I know that, and I hope everyone factors this in, I know that I and others in my position will not always be getting it 100% right, even for what. And I'm not saying, by the way, that there is such thing as an 100% right.
Yes.
There's no one answer. You know,
right?
There is a subjectivity involved, and you distance yourself as much as you make an effort to de-bias yourself. But you're always going to have your set of experiences that you bringing to it, and you're going to bring your set of exposure. I mean, things that you've seen before. If you see something, like if I see something, and I say, "Oh, this is familiar to me. I've seen this so many times. That will be true to me, but it won't necessarily be true to a lot of people who see a lot less than I do. You know?
Sure.
So these are different little weird factors that I try in some... I mean, there's no organized way to do it, but I do try to step back when I can and get some perspective.
Do you ever find yourself thinking to yourself, you know, oh, I really maybe did not enjoy this show, but I know that the readers of Time Out would, so let me put it through that lens? Or is it always, you know, your opinion without the outside factors of the publication coming in?
Yes and no. Yes. I'm not saying – I wouldn't say necessarily the readers of Time Out per se, although maybe to some extent, because I have an idealized vision of what the readers of Time Out means. Mm-hmm. And that may or may not be true to everyone who reads the magazine or the website. But it is, I think, true, and this is why I feel very lucky to have ended up here. Time Out is aimed at people, at a certain kind of person. It's aimed at someone who is looking to go out in the city and find interesting new cultural things to do. So it is an engaged audience, and it's a curious audience. Mm. And I think to some extent it is, although it's a general audience, it's a sort of a more informed subset of the general audience. Okay. And so I write with that in mind. I like to assume that my readers are smart and that they are looking for interesting, cool stuff. And I want to pitch it on that level. But at the same time, yes, there are things that appeal to me more personally, and I try to, when it happens to be just something that tickles my, what I know to be my personal fancy, I try to separate that out from just writing it, you know, from writing, yeah.
No, that's so interesting.
And conversely, more often, when it's something that just doesn't happen to really be my thing, I try to remain generous to it and understand that just because I don't like, you know, raw cauliflower, it doesn't mean that raw cauliflower is inedible. It just means it's my taste.
But we can all agree that raw cauliflower is inedible, so I think we're okay there.
It's always the last thing on the raw food.
Yeah,
right?
It just stays there.
It's the way the carrots and the peppers, and then it's just half a plate of raw broccoli and cauliflower.
Just chilling. Just chilling. So now this past decade of theater has been so interesting. You know, in the beginning of the decade, you know, are the two plays that win Best Play are you know, coming in from England. And then all of a sudden we get this, you know, wealth of American plays, one after the other, like Clybourne Park, Vanya, Sonia. So I'm curious, how do you feel the decade has transitioned itself from the beginning, 2010, to where we are in 2019?
Well, we certainly still have no shortage of British.
That's true.
Yes. There is an enormous pipeline. There's an enormous pipeline. That can be great because we get a lot of best British stuff, and it's kind of it's already been vetted for us.
Yes.
And so I'm not complaining about that because we do end up getting to see a great deal of wonderful stuff. I do think sometimes there's a bit of an Anglophile fetishization of English productions, and that can sometimes be frustrating when I think there are a lot of great American productions in off-Broadway houses that could very easily be imagined on Broadway, and for some reason, I think we're getting a little better at that. And by we, I mean the theater industry. I mean, to the extent that I'm included in that. But I mean, it's mostly producers. And there are certain practical reasons for why this happens. Obviously, there are relationships that exist. And also, the existence of a whole successful production somewhere else makes it much easier to transfer to Broadway without worrying about the risk as much.
Absolutely.
You could just pick it up and put it down. That said, there are specific situations in which I find it frustrating. I liked the revival of Angels in America very much a few years ago, but the idea of bringing a cast of British people to do a modern American play in America is strange to me. And I wonder whether anyone in England can imagine a cast of American actors coming and doing a contemporary British play with English accents in the West End. It's unimaginable. Yeah. And the fact that it is imaginable to us is weird.
Yes.
It reflects to some extent how inured we've become to this to the influx of London theater. And that's not a complaint about that theater per se. I like a great deal of it. But I wish there were most of my, when I look back on the past decade, many of my favorite shows were off-Broadway shows. Some of them are too weird and would never have transferred to Broadway, but many of them are not and would have been imaginable on Broadway. And I wish that more people had gotten to see some of them.
And can you give us a couple of titles just off the top of your head that you feel go into that category?
Off the top of my head. Let's see. No. I mean,
or off-Broadway productions in this past decade you enjoyed.
Off the top of my head, some of the plays that I've loved the most in the past few years, just in the past few years, a play called An Octoroon that was off-Broadway twice, a play called Fairview that was off-Broadway twice. You know, there is a market for these plays. Now, both of those plays present certain logistical problems, you know, in a traditional proscenium Broadway theater, but it is possible to imagine working around them. Natasha Pierre and The Great Comet of 1812 proposed similar theoretical problems, and I think they did a very good job of making it work in Broadway space. Hand to God was not a show that anyone thought would transfer to Broadway.
Yeah.
I thought it did great on Broadway. Avenue Q was not a show that people thought would be on Broadway. I think that if people have the will, then they can have the way.
Yes.
And it would be nice. But, you know, we are – Slave Play is another show that I didn't think was going to transfer, has transferred. I'm very glad it has. Oklahoma is another positive example of that. So I think that we are starting to take some of these risks a bit more. And certainly there are producers like Scott Rudin who are taking very ambitious – steps in that direction, who are bringing new plays by people like Taylor Mack to Broadway on principle because he believes that that's what Broadway can do. And not all of those plays will be successes, but most plays are not successes on Broadway.
True.
So it's not unique to strange plays, Lord knows. But I think that's been a good trend recently. I think we've had a bit more of that, and I would love to see more of that.
Yeah. I think. And on the flip side, now, what trends or ideas did you see sort of dissolve in the past decade? Things that maybe were hung over from the early 2000s now starting to dissipate.
I don't know. You know, when people talk about trends, I usually bristle a little bit because often that kind of thing is an accident.
Mm. Mm.
By the time something develops as a trend, it's usually over. And the development times of these plays is longer than people imagine, especially musicals. So when things happen at their own time, they kind of happen accidentally, depending on – I mean, things that have been in development for a long time suddenly appear, and it looks like they're both doing the same thing. But actually, they were developed independently of each other, and they don't have anything to do with each other. So – I'm a little wary about looking at themes that way. I do think that we're seeing long-term changes that are continuing to happen, that were true in the 2000s and have become true in the 2010s. I think we're moving away from the Great American Songbook style of musical theater writing in various ways, and that's true not just in that we have fewer revivals of classic shows, but also in the way that people write new shows. We're moving away from the emphasis on sort of a jazz spine. We're moving away from the emphasis on perfect rhyme, and people's ears are changing, and that's just an evolution of how things happen. So even the shows that even shows by people like Pascal and Paul or Lin-Manuel Miranda, people who do have a deep grounding in and love of American musical theater, they don't always observe the same rules as old musicals used to, and that's fine if they do them well, you know. But
yes,
that's a change. We're certainly continuing to see the change in what kinds of plays get made on Broadway, with exceptions. They tend to be smaller plays now. They tend to be shorter plays,
mm-hmm.
plays with one sort of strange, dark, modular set, and four people, you know.
Yes, yes.
And those, for obvious reasons, those are easier to produce. So it's fewer shows like You Can't Take It With You, where you have 50 people on stage, you know.
Right.
And more plays like Art. And there are also, for understandable reasons, there are fewer big personality stars who are marketable on their personas the way that you used to have. Actors today have to be more versatile. You can't be Carol Channing and make a career out of playing two people.
That's 50 right.
years. And she did great, and God bless Carol Channing. She's amazing. But she was able to do that because you could do that. And now you can't. You can't really do that. So you get people who have to be able to sing to these crazy places. Everything that's being written now is written for... You know, when Patti LuPone was singing that stuff in 1979, no one else was singing that way.
Right.
No one expected anyone to go up to a high D. And now everyone expects that.
Right.
It's a little bit like figure skating, you know, when you watch it, how they keep on pushing, you know, now women are supposed to land a quadruple axel or whatever.
Oh my God.
And no one did that 20 years ago. No one. So those levels keep on rising. The levels of technical requirement keep on rising, and meanwhile, the margin that leaves for a kind of quirky individual personality shrink a little.
Mm.
That's not anyone's fault.
No, and now, you know, a lot of people have been coming to Broadway from Hollywood over the past 10 years. There seems to be an influx of, you know, stars. Have there been any, like, quote-unquote movie stars who surprised you with their stage technique?
Well, many of them. The other thing is, okay, so what we're talking about there is, again, a change in the way that Broadway plays happen. The idea of a long-running Broadway play has kind of died.
Yeah.
And there are just very, very few of them. And so now mostly the model is to have a short run with a marketable star recoup your investment if you can, and maybe make a little top, and then close happy, and everyone goes away having done a nice thing and made a little money. But the idea of running for 5 years on a play, there's no Life with Fathers anymore. You know, there's no Tobacco Roads anymore. There isn't even a Torch Song Trilogy or a Gemini. Those kinds of plays don't happen. And when they do, they tend to be very big, spectacular musical type plays like War Horse or Curious Incident. And even those don't have the kinds of runs that plays used
to.
But that said, so yes, stage, so-called Hollywood stars can often give wonderful performances on stage. But what a lot of people forget is that these Hollywood stars, before they were Hollywood stars, often came out of the theater and have
right.
in it, you know? So big surprise, Kate Blanchett's wonderful on stage. Yeah, because she did a lot of stage work. Big surprise, Hugh Jackman can do musicals because Hugh Jackman started off doing musicals and became a star doing Oklahoma and before he was Wolverine. You know, and so when they come back, often, but also people sometimes who don't have experience can surprise you in good ways. There's also something. You know, theater is a weird thing, and so much of it depends on the charisma of a star, the star performance, because in some ineffable way, it's about their ability to command attention on stage, and some stars have that naturally on stage and can shape that fascination on stage, and some stars implode. Some stars who are very good on screen don't know how to translate that into a live moment in a way that sustains over the course of a long scene. And they don't know how to hold themselves. They don't know how to carry their energy over into an audience. But experience isn't always the thing. An example that I give a lot on this is Fantasia in The Color Purple, which I saw in the original production of Color Purple. Right. When she came in, she had, as far as I know, no acting experience. She had just come off of American Idol.
American Idol, yeah.
And she was magnificent in Color Purple. I mean, not only did she sing the shit out of it, but she also had what seemed to be a deep connection to the role, a deep understanding of the role, and also the fact of her stardom made her interesting and gave her confidence, and that everyone in the audience was responding so strongly to her presence there that it pulled the show together in a way that for me it hadn't come together before when LaShawn's was doing it. LaShawn's very, very talented, but the show hadn't seemed as clearly to be about Celie with LaShawn's in it as it was with Fantasia, because Fantasia's charisma made her the central character in Lieutenants.
That's so interesting.
But that's really one of the things about getting to do what I do is the opportunity to see the same production over the course of time or with different actors, and that can be really fascinating what people bring or don't bring. And usually the production is at its very best when it opens or within the first few months of when it opens for various reasons, but among other things, the production is tailored to the talents of its cast, and that's especially true of original shows, and it's especially true of musicals, where there are a lot of changes being made up until the last, you know, minute, and often that will be about whether something gets a laugh.
Yeah. You know?
And so if the original performer is not getting that laugh, then it will be gone, and it'll be gone forever.
Yeah.
You know? And then whoever comes in is ultimately doing a character that was molded around the skill set of the original person. And so if you can see the original person, it's best to do that. That said, I've seen lots of replacements who have been for me superior to the people who originally played them in that production. Even sometimes when the original person is a terrific performer.
Sure.
And often when they won a Tony for that performance, you know, sometimes Tony Awards are another one of those things where it's really year to year, you know?
Right.
And there's other factors.
Absolutely.
Hey, podcast listeners, are you looking for a place to rehearse in New York City that is clean, spacious, and most importantly, affordable? Come check out Shetler Studios and Theaters, our wonderful host for these podcasts. Shetler is centrally located on West 54th Street between Broadway and 8th Avenue, right in the heart of the theater district.
Right in the heart, you'll find music, dance, and acting studios, complemented by 2 black box theaters and 6 presentation venues. The professional facilities, inspired environment, and expert industry staff combine to provide the New York artist with an unparalleled studio experience.
Visit their website at ShetlerStudios.com. That's S-H-E-T-L-E-R Studios.com.
Shetler Studios and Theaters is our home for recording the legends of Broadway, and we hope that you make it your artistic home too.
That's Shetler, S-H-E-T-L-E-R Studios.com. See you here.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Now, of course, you know, none of these shows would be in theaters without playwrights. So my question for you is, over this past decade, who were some of the top playwrights you saw emerge in the 2010s?
There were a lot of them. And here's where... you'll notice that a lot of these ones for me are off-Broadway playwrights.
Love it.
But they are, when I look back on the 2010s, I think about people like Annie Baker. Mm. I think about people like Samuel D. Hunter. who has a play now called The Greater Clements at Lincoln Center that I think is really beautiful. I think of Jackie Sibley's Drury, who wrote Fairview. I think of Taylor Mack. I think of Stephen Parham.
Yes.
I think of Claire Barron, who wrote Dance Nation and You Get Older. I think of Amy Herzog, wrote Mary Jane a couple of years ago, which was just a gorgeous play. And most of these plays, I mean, Karam's The Humans did go to Broadway. Taylor Mack had a Broadway play last year. The other of the seven people I just mentioned, five of them have not yet been on Broadway. So that speaks to what we were talking about before a little bit, that a lot of the best theater, for me, the most interesting stuff is still happening in these off-Broadway spaces. And the problem with that is that by the time you find out it's good, it can be very hard to get tickets.
Right.
And one beautiful trend of the 2010s that has been really encouraging is the rise of this kind of encore runs.
Yes.
People bring back a production, an off-Broadway production, for a second run. And this happened with Octoroon. This happened with Fairview. It's happening right now with This Is a Room at the Vineyard. It's something that we're seeing more and more, and that is really encouraging because it can be really frustrating when you get excited about a show and you want to share it with people, and then you go online and you just realize, too late. Yeah. People can line up, and there's lotteries and things like that. Right. There's cancellation lists, but most people don't have the time to do that.
And these regional theaters or these off-Broadway theaters have subscribers, and they, you know, their seats are filled before it's even, released.
It's wrapped up. And so these are small theaters. These are 200-seat theaters and limited runs. So, one answer is read the reviews when they come out. Read the ones that you trust and really act fast. And another one is find playwrights that you think are consistently delivering work that's worth seeing. I have certainly ones that I am always going to be interested in seeing, and take the risk and buy their tickets in advance, because chances are, even if it's not their best play, it'll still be worth your time.
Take the risk. That's such fabulous advice. Kevin, any playwrights from your end that you really admired in the past decade?
Well, there's I'm more on the Broadway side, and one of the commercial guys who does not shy away from writing a long show, but Jez Butterworth, who gave us The Ferryman and gave us Jerusalem, was one of my favorite plays many years ago with Mark Rylance. Everything that Mark Rylance is in, I of course love, but I think Jez Butterworth really has shocked us. I'm excited for Jeremy Harris to write some more and see what else we got. I think what he's doing to Broadway and polarizing is a beautiful thing, with a great piece of writing as well, and I'm excited to see what he's going to have next. What about you, Rob?
I was going to give a shout out to Terrell Alvin McCraney, whose work I just really, really admire. You know, Choir Boy in the Brothers Sisters plays, and Lucas Nath, who did Doll's House Part Two, which I thought was just a mesmerizing evening in the theater.
Yes, yes, and yes. I agree with all of those. What I said before is not to say that we haven't had a lot of plays that I've liked very much on Broadway. And certainly both of those Jez Butterworth plays that you mentioned are highlights for me, too. I thought that The Humans was great. I thought Hand to God was great. I thought one of my very favorite plays of the past 10 years is Good People by David Lindsay Barrow.
Oh, yeah.
That was just a terrific play, I thought. I thought the best play of its season. We've had a lot of really good revivals also of plays. Normal Heart, the revival of The Normal Heart, I thought was really memorable. I thought that the Jessica Lange Long Day's Journey Into Night was really memorable for me. So there will always be that, and there will be performances. Oh my gosh. So you mentioned Mark Rylance. I mean, it's been an amazing trip.
This decade, so many. Yes. He's done so many, from La Bette all the way on. I mean, he just kept giving us so much.
La Bette
varied
in this season,
right?
It's astonishing. And Twelfth Night, he was marvelous in. And when you have people like that, and then on the female side, you have Laurie Metcalf, who's become the new Broadway pillar, and who is just again just a delight every time she's out, even when the play is not quite deserving. You get a lot of wonderful, and the level of, and Bryan Cranston in All the Way. And,
oh my
and,
God. Yeah.
You love that, Rob. Yeah.
Really great performances. Speaking of Hand to God, Stephen Boyer, the lead in Hand to God, was giving just one of those performances that I will treasure. Viola Davis in Fences.
Mm. Yep.
Nina Arianda in Venus and Fur, if you remember that.
Oh yes. I loved her. Yeah.
Hugh Dancy. Yeah.
Frances McDormand in Good People was as perfect for that part, I think. Christine Nielsen in Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike.
Hysterical. One of the funniest performances.
There it is. And last year, I mean, Elaine May in Waverly Gallery, and Glenda Jackson in the year before that. Last season and the season before.
Yeah, yeah.
Glenda Jackson in Three Tall Women, that production generally is, I thought, as good as a Broadway production can be.
Right.
And remarkable design. There have been a lot of directors. Joe Mantello directed that Three Tall Women, and he's also, if we talk about like the Mark Rylances and the Laurie Metcalfs, we also have directors who keep on delivering.
Yes.
And those are people like Joe Mantello, who did The Humans and Blackbird and Three Tall Women.
Yep.
And people like Bart Scherer, who did, you know, not just musicals, but also shows like Oslo and Golden Boy and Tacoma.
Oh, yeah.
And Marion Elliott.
Oh, my God.
The Angels in America, and also Curious Incident, and also War Horse. You know, these are...
And Company this season, yeah.
Yeah.
This
season, fingers crossed. And Joe Mantello also back as an actor in The Normal Heart, which was great to see.
Oh, he was so brilliant in that. My God.
I saw him in Angels in America in the 90s when I was a wee one. When I was a wee one. And that was, I remember his Lewis in Angels in America very well. That was a really seminal performance for me.
He's such a special artist. Such a special artist. Actually, really quickly, I want to ask you, Adam, do you remember the first Broadway show you ever saw?
I don't remember which was which. I remember the first two that I saw, because I remember the trip that it was. And I don't remember whether we saw the play first or the musical first, but I saw Torch Song Trilogy. I saw Brighton Beach Memoirs.
Oh.
And I saw Sunday in the Park with George.
Oh my God. Well, that's kind of a genius trip, isn't it?
Those are good ones. Those are good ones.
Yeah, it was great. It was Sunday in the Park with George. I saw the original leads were already out of it. I saw Robert Westenberg and Marianne Plunkett as and Dot. And it was I loved it. I remember loving the first act and being a little confused by the second act. That's
same.
I'm honest.
Still,
yeah. I think that's the consistent.
That's the thing, you know. If you like Sondheim shows, and I do. Then the nice thing about that is that slowly starts to change and start really digging the beak cuts, you know.
I love it. Hey, Kev, anything for you? Any Broadway productions or directors or performers that you thought were really exemplary this year? This decade.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, a director that keeps coming up is Anna Shapiro. I feel like she's just been everywhere. And then also Tripp Coleman. I think we're going to see a lot more of his work. I know that, you know, Significant Other, Rob, is one of you. You know, we've talked about that.
I
before.
Love that play. Yeah.
I can't get through this podcast without bringing up Eva Van Hove, because this is the decade that brought us A View from the Bridge, where they're barefoot on stage and everyone was like, what the hell is going on? And then he just keeps on giving us more fascinating, head-scratching moments in the theater. But as far as productions that I was completely devastated and wiped away with was just a couple years ago, Indecent. It also gave us Katrina Lenk, which was like a revolution. But I was so completely moved by Indecent that it just really, to this day, still stays with me. And some of the visions and the themes that I saw in that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Beautiful, beautiful production. The whole Adina Versen, who is in that, also is she's been popping up a lot in little off Broadway plays. And when I say little, I don't mean that dismissively. I mean smaller productions. She's really gifted, it's been Indecent was magical. But there's another example of a show that began off Broadway and I think was very beautiful, transferred very beautifully to Broadway. Mm-hmm. So there's so much. There always is so much. This is the challenge of keeping up in this city.
Yeah,
there are trends. How should I say? There are less salutary trends. As well, you know,
I'll take that.
But I often feel even when. Okay, so someone like Ivo van Hove, I'm a little bit on the fence about what he's been doing more recently. Maybe it's just that I'm a little Evo'd out, having seen so much of his work over the years, and I saw a lot of it off Broadway, and I'm really thrilled that it has moved to this new sphere. I think that it pushes the Overton window, it pushes the envelope of what can be done on Broadway, and I think to some extent. Things like the Daniel Fish Oklahoma, which I love, that's on Broadway right now, reflects a little bit the after effects of those two Evo revivals that we had a few years ago. It just meant that people could look at something that was unconventionally directed, unconventional for Broadway, very conventional if you go to BAM on a regular basis, but is unconventional for Broadway and that it could be successful, that it could move people. I think we're going to be seeing a bit more of that quote-unquote unconventional director-driven.
Yes.
Which is exciting, I think.
Yeah, it can really open up a text if it works right. I thought that, for me, the Evo view from a bridge worked a lot more effectively than the Evo Crucible. The Evo Crucible just felt a little confused to me and thus confusing. I mean, it created the possibility that you could come away from the Crucible thinking that the Crucible was, that the attitude toward it was like, well, maybe they were witches.
Yeah. Right.
and I don't know if that's really what Arthur Miller was going for.
Right.
But certainly they were very effectively staged in some ways. They were very striking, and they were very memorable, some of their key imagery. And I'm very curious to see what he's going to do with West Side Story. I'm sure people will be up in arms.
Already are, yeah.
Yeah.
But that's exciting.
You can't just do the same thing over and over again. And I love the same thing. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'm very happy to have a traditional revival. Some of my most pleasurable evenings at the theater. That Mark Rylance Twelfth Night, which was as traditional as it gets, was glorious for me. The Patti LuPone Gypsy was a more or less standard revival, and for me, connected in all the right ways. I'm not opposed to this. But give things some air. Let them breathe to a new generation.
There was
an old Saturday Night Live sketch. This is a digression, but there was an old Saturday Night Live sketch years ago with Phil Hartman and Jan Hartman.
Adam, this is my favorite sketch of SNL of all time, and I talk about it on the podcast, but go ahead.
Really? Have you talked about it before?
I do. Ad nauseum, but please do it because makes me so happy.
It's Nora Dunn and Phil Hartman, and Phil is playing an actor in a regional production of The King and I, and they keep asking him about Yul Brynner and that, why, you know, how does it compare to Yul Brynner, and how do you step into Yul Brynner's footsteps, and why aren't you bald, and you know, all these, and finally he breaks down into tears, and his wife starts berating the host, and she says, basically, my husband is a good man, my husband is a good actor, he's trying his best, and he says, if you want Yul Brynner, dig him up. And I think there's something to that, like, you can say all you you want Yul Brynner, dig him. We're not gonna see Yul Brynner again.
Now don't judge me, Adam, I actually have that quote, and I have it on a t-shirt.
I'm not judging you.
Great. That makes me so. But it's true. You need air. You need to reinvent. You need to allow people to explore these shows under a different lens. Otherwise, what's the point of why we're doing it?
Right. And it has to speak to a new audience. And things that were funny to us 50 years ago are not necessarily funny to us now.
That's right.
And things that were. And a lot of that, I was talking about this recently on another show, so I don't want to go into it, I don't want to bore your audience if they are listening to multiple versions of me talking on podcasts. But it's true. Sometimes, you know, just a show connects with a different generation in a new way because it has things embedded in it. If it's a good enough show, it'll have a lot of things going on. And sometimes different colors will come out in different lighting, you know?
No, that's so true.
Absolutely.
And then finally, to wrap up, what do you think were some of the biggest theatrical news stories of the decade?
Oh, boy.
Charging your phone at Hand of God?
You're charging your phone.
Well, look, I mean, Hamilton is the big Broadway story of the 2000s. It's the big musical theater story of the past 50 years. There's no, well, of the, at least in the past 50 years. There's been nothing like it. There's been nothing like it in terms of the pop crossover.
Yeah.
Of Hamilton. This was a mass culture success in a musical theater piece that has not been known really since the 60s, probably. Not even things like A Chorus Line or Cats. Those were not the most downloaded, you know.
Yes.
This was a crossover hit with the real general public, and that never happens anymore. That is very exciting, and also what that represents. The one of the larger trends that we've been seeing a lot more of recently, and I think this is nice too, is this trend of racially inclusive casting and of racially blind casting, ethnicity blind casting, gender blind casting. This more idea of making space for different communities, and conversely, bizarrely, because the world is complicated, sometimes a more specific and limited idea of who and only who can be cast in certain roles. So we've become very, very sensitive to issues of cultural representation. So issues related to anything perceived as a relative of blackface, and that is expanding daily.
Yeah.
In terms of who can play, you know, can non-gay people can play gay characters? Can non-disabled people can play disabled characters? So there's a bit of a contraction on that part of the casting side, and on the other part of the casting side, there's an enormous expansion. So in a production like Oklahoma, you have a woman who used a wheelchair. You have three actors of color in the cast, and are being used in very specific ways that bring out what the show is doing. So they in cases like that, they are using race in very particular ways. And then you have other cases where it's just being used invisibly, and in the sort of Audra McDonald and Carousel model, where it's just part of the suspension of disbelief. So I think that the landscape for all of that has been changing very rapidly in interesting ways. We've certainly seen an exhausting influx for me of musicals, especially that are based on films, based on successful brand name films, and jukebox musicals and bio musicals that are based on successful bodies of work. I think that we have seen so many of those that I would be very surprised if we did not see a counter reaction and an exhaustion factor from the general audience for that. Because ultimately, if you look at the real big successes, the ones that are really defining the past 10 years on Broadway, you're looking at original shows.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at the Book of Mormon. You're looking at Hamilton. You're looking at Dear Evan Hansen. You know, and
Come From Away.
And Come From Away. You know, those are the ones that really connect with people, and that's because they come from distinct creative voices, and they are telling new stories that are developed to speak to modern audiences, and not just to tap into audiences' nostalgia for what they felt 20 or 30, 50 years ago. And so that's something that I think everyone is bearing in mind.
I think that's very exciting, because I'm excited to see then what the next decade holds. Adam, I cannot tell you how much we appreciate you taking time out to talk to us today. You are one of our most beloved critics. We love reading your work, and we thank you so much for all that you've given us over the past few years.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Thanks. All right, everybody. Till next time.
Today's episode was recorded at Shetler Studios on 244 West 54th Street. Visit Shetler Studios to book your room today, and you could be as cool as us. That's S-H-E-T-L-E-R studios.com.
And a big thanks to our sound editor, Daniel Schwartzberg, and social media manager, Bethany Ann Selecki.
And friends, don't forget, we want more folks to hear these incredible stories, and that's where you guys can come in and help us out.
Yes, in order for people to find out about us, we need lots of ratings on iTunes. The more ratings, the more they'll come up in searches. So head on over to iTunes, search for Behind the Curtain Broadway's Living Legends, click on our logo, click on ratings and reviews, then write a review and leave us 5 stars and make us feel as special as Eliza Doolittle on Eliza Doolittle Day.
Or you can leave us 1 star and make us feel as bad as Annie did in that weird production in Boston where Annie dreamed about being adopted and then ended the show back in the orphanage. True story, Rob was there.
I saw it. So head on over to iTunes and make us feel even more special than we already do.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.